Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Several recent studies on incarceration of Native Americans point to a growing population of Native women behind bars. One study by the Sentencing Project in 2019 finds Native girls under 18 years of age had the highest incarceration rate of any other group. Advocates are promoting justice reforms, strengthening reentry resources, and developing more research to curb the trend. More on Native women and girls justice reform after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Construction on a memorial to honor the nearly 50 documented children who died at a Rapid City Indian boarding school starts soon. Officials say crews will finish the memorial by Native American Day in October. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Lee Strubinger has more.
After World War II, the city of Rapid City, through a congressional authorization, annexed 1,200 acres of land in West Rapid City. The move displaced Natives living near the former Sioux Sanatorium. Native Americans were then moved to what's considered North Rapid. A new memorial will pay homage to that displacement, as well as honor 50 children believed to have died while the facility was a boarding school.
The intention is really to build empathy and understanding in our community.
That's Amy Sazu, executive director of the Remembering the Children Memorial.
To help people understand their community members and neighbors a little bit better, understand race relations in our community a little bit better, see some of the symptoms of historical trauma, and understand that, you know, understand those that are still suffering from the impacts of historical trauma a little bit better.
The memorial will be built on tribal trust land belonging to the Rosebud, Oglala, and Cheyenne River Sioux tribes. Once construction is complete, the next phase of the memorial will take shape, which is art installation. Sazu, who is Lakota, says the memorial will look like a public art space.
The spirit of different parts of the story have to be present, and there's no better way than to do that than through art.
The memorial will also feature a sculpture by Indigenous artists. The sculpture will likely be installed by spring of 2025. I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
Tribes across the country observed Monday's solar eclipse in various ways or took time to reflect during its occurrence. Tribes have different beliefs and stories regarding solar eclipses, with cultural narratives that vary. The Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma held a solar eclipse viewing party. One of Cherokee Nation's stories focuses on a frog. As educator, storyteller, and Cherokee Nation national treasure, Robert Lewis explains, the story originates around the 1800s. Lewis says Cherokee people gathered and noticed a darkness across the landscape. They noticed the sun being covered, a giant frog swallowing the sun, so they decided to scare it away. Here's part of the story Lewis shared on social media.
They decided they're going to try to scare it away. So the medicine people said, we need to frighten it away. So they pulled out their guns and firearms and began to shoot them in the air. They began to sit there, take pots and pans, and began to bang on them and scream and yell and do whatever kind of noise they could make to frighten the frog away. Eventually, the sun came back, the mouth let go, and the frog disappeared. That's basically the story that we got. It's been passed down. Storyteller is a storyteller. I can embellish it. You can have other aspects of the creature showing up. This has been going for days trying to figure out what's going on. For the most part, the basic story talks about the fact that the frog was coming to swallow the sun, and we scared it away.
Lewis says during an eclipse, Cherokee people will often go out and try and frighten the frog away. The Choctaw Nation in Oklahoma also held activities and events across Choctaw country to observe and educate. A Choctaw story involves a black squirrel who nibbled the sun as Choctaw people noticed it getting darker, so they scared the squirrel away. The Navajo Nation, located in the Four Corners region, views the eclipse as a sacred time, traditionally staying indoors, praying, and reflecting. The Navajo Nation kept the executive branch open as well as essential services, including police and hospitals. The solar eclipse crossed North America, where people gathered at various locations, especially in the path of totality, from Mexico across the United States, from Texas to Maine, and Canada's Atlantic coast. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by BNSF Railway, proudly supporting the nation's economy by moving the goods that feed, supply, and power communities across the country. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Numerous studies over the years point to the overrepresentation of Native American women in the nation's prisons. A study by the Sentencing Project over more than 20 years found a 525% increase in the incarceration rate for women and girls. Juvenile Native American girls had the highest rate at more than four times that of their white counterparts. Nonprofit and tribal advocates are looking at ways to bring down those numbers. Solutions include demanding equitable sentencing, promoting traditional culture inside prisons, addressing the school-to-prison pipeline, and putting resources into reentry programs. We'll talk with Native advocates today about the trends and possible solutions. We want to note that this program is part of our Native Americans in the Justice System series, supported in part by the Public Welfare Foundation. You can join today's conversation by calling into the show at 1-800-996-2848. That number is also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now from San Francisco, California, is Dr. Karma Corcoran. She is the director of the Indian Law Program at Lewis and Clark Law School and an adjunct professor in the Indigenous Nation Studies Program at Portland State University. She is Chippewa Cree. Hello, Dr. Corcoran, and welcome back to NAC.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much for having me back.
It's a pleasure to have you. Also joining us today in Bozeman, Montana, is Dr. Lori Walker. They are an assistant teaching professor at the Department of Native American Studies at Montana State University. Dr. Walker, welcome to Native America Calling as well.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And our third guest joins us from Anchorage, Alaska. Dean Williams. He is an independent consultant with experience running penal institutions in Alaska. Welcome to the show, Dean.
It's great to be on, Sean. Thank you.
You bet. Dr. Corcoran, I'd like to begin with you, and let's talk about this term incarceration. We hear it thrown around a lot. We read it. We see it on television. How do you define that word for our listeners?
I define it as the holding of people, the penning in of people, and I would argue that the first incarceration, even before there were jails or prisons on this land, you know, that was brought here by colonialism, happened in various ways, including the boarding school system, including reservations themselves. So how you incarcerate people can be both physical and, of course, spiritual and mental also.
Interesting perspective, Dr. Corcoran. Now, we did mention some statistics at the start of the show. What are some especially troubling trends or other statistics you'd like to share with our listeners that really stand out when it comes to this issue of incarcerated Native women?
I think we have to start with juvenile justice and the fact that Native girls are very, unfortunately, well represented on the school-to-prison pipeline. Also, many Native girls who then become Native women come from places where they're removed from their family and their culture. That includes foster homes. I did a workshop with 12 women at the women's prison here in, I'm in San Francisco, but I'm home in Portland, Oregon, and 90% of them were in foster homes. So of those that started their journey in the juvenile system, they ended up then going on to prison. And the sentencing in the juvenile system is very unfair and very uneven when it comes to Native girls. If I was to take Portland, Oregon, if a white girl gets picked up for being a runaway or whatever she's charged with, she's much more likely to become part of some sort of program or intervention as opposed to going into the juvenile system. And so we have to look at that trend in order to look at the number of Native women that we have incarcerated. I would also say that the world has changed, you know, in that back in the day, before women were incarcerated, it was very unusual. It was, you know, well, we shouldn't lock up women. You know, we should do these other things with them, turn them over to their husbands or whatever. But once we started incarcerating women and the types of things that became misdemeanors and felonies, such as shoplifting to feed my family, the number of women then incarcerated really increased. So I think we have to look at all of those things when we look at the incarceration of women.
Dr. Corcoran, you talked about how, especially with juveniles, with young Native girls, when their white counterparts might get arrested for a similar offense, they're more likely to benefit from some type of intervention or participation in a program, as opposed to Native girls. Why is that? I mean, I do understand that there's challenges with getting good legal representation and resources. What else is there that's preventing Native women, especially these younger girls, from getting proper treatment through the legal system?
There's a number of things. One is racism. There's also the system doesn't allow for hearing your story. How did you get here? Developing relationship to tell the story. In fact, I'm presenting on that in just a few minutes here in San Francisco. So the way that Native girls share their story, share what happened to them, doesn't happen in one sitting with a police officer, a officer of the court, a judge, an advocate, because a number of reasons. One, we are a people that it takes time to develop trust and relationship. Two, we're not as likely to just share the whole thing, such as, you know, unfortunately, you know, I may be being abused at home. It could be a relative. It could be mom's boyfriend. Lots of different things. And to be honest with you, if you take the same crime, whatever that might be, and you have a white juvenile, they're going to look at those things. And you'll see in the news things like, well, she was a cheerleader and she was a really good student and she comes from a really good home, so we're not going to sentence her. Instead, you know, we're going to get her some counseling. Maybe she'll have to do some community service, but it's completely different. So racism runs deep in the system itself.
Dr. Corcoran, we uncovered an interesting statistic that Native women represent a much higher number of the incarcerated population without being sentenced. What's driving that?
I'm not quite sure. I think there's a number of things, including the variance from state to state. I would say here in Oregon, what a judge can decide is very limited due to something called Measure 11. And so it really varies from state to state what the power of the county or state has over somebody who has committed a crime.
Mm-hmm. And, Measure 11? I'm sorry, what is Measure 11?
Oh, it's just the most awful thing. So it's a voter initiative. And so Measure 11 has set a paradigm for judges. So let's say I'm a Native American woman. I have been accused of and found guilty of a crime relating to drugs and alcohol. I've had another crime before. The judge looks at this matrix, and based on the matrix, the judge will then sentence me to prison. Usually, I think the minimum sentence would be 3, but it's usually 5 years or more. So the judge cannot say, okay, this is a woman of domestic violence. You know, this is happening. This is happening. She's got a drug or alcohol problem. Clearly, a program would be best for her. So Measure 11 really gives the judge little leeway. And what's unfortunate about it is it cannot be overturned because unless there's a voter instinct to do so. And that has not happened.
All right. Thank you. Dr. Corcoran, I'm sorry, we're going to take a short break here. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Karma Corcoran and our other guests with regard to these alarming rates of incarceration for Native American women. Join the conversation, join the discussion, share your comments and thoughts at 1-800-996-2848. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Without any evidence, the governor of South Dakota claims tribal leaders in her state are, in her words, personally benefiting from Mexican cartels. Her comments are part of a series of damaging rhetoric by public officials scoring political points at the expense of tribes. We'll get a perspective on what's behind the trend on the next Native America Calling.
This program is supported by AmeriCorps Vista. You can kickstart your career by joining thousands of AmeriCorps members in the VISTA program serving to alleviate poverty. AmeriCorps members help organizations make change right in their own community. A service opportunity that fits your ambition can be found at AmeriCorps.gov/VISTA today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/VISTA.
You're listening to Native America Calling. We are talking about incarcerated Native women and girls today. The numbers show an upward trend. Is this a problem you've just now been made aware of, or are you familiar with the issue? If so, how does your community or tribe advocate for Native women in the justice system? Is there support for women transitioning out of prison? You can join us, share your comments by calling 1-800-996-2848. The number again to our Albuquerque studio, 1-800-996-2848. Our first guest, Dr. Karma Corcoran, joins us from San Francisco, California. And Dr. Corcoran, I'm sorry, we had to take a quick break there. I just about cut you off mid-sentence. Please continue your train of thought.
I can't remember it because I'm old.
Well, let me ask you about this, because you wrote a book. It's titled The Incarceration of Native American Women, Creating Pathways to Wellness and recovery through gentle action theory. Tell us more about that gentle action theory, if you can remember what it means. I'm just kidding.
I can. So gentle action theory, I was first exposed to when I was doing my PhD, and I was fortunate enough to have a couple courses with F. David Peet, who was my professor. He has since walked on, and he was a physicist. And I was drawn to gentle action theory because at its core, it's about addressing societal issues. And ideally, that work starts from within a community. So, for example, as Native people, we've had a very long time and very many experiences of people coming into our communities and saying, oh my God, you people have an alcohol problem. We're going to have a workshop. We might give your participants $20. We'll feed them. They might get a certificate. And then they're going to tell us how to handle this problem. Well, lots of things do happen and lots of things don't happen. One thing that doesn't happen from the beginning is there's no establishing of trust and relationship, of seeking from the community what they are thinking about this. It's also different from the Western way in that it's about pausing and having dialogue and pondering creative solutions. Whereas I'm sure we've all been to conferences in some, you know, conference room at Holiday Inn, and by the end of the day, we've solved world hunger. Well, that just does not happen. The other things about gentle action theory is that it's one of respect. So when I do research, for example, for the book, it's about making sure that who I am involved in research knows what I'm doing it, why I'm doing it. When they signed that release, they need to know that in some small sense, they have sold me their story. And it's up to me to, it's up to me to come back around again, to disseminate that information to the community, because that's, I'm not Native American calling, because that's not something that happens. They also need to understand that as researchers, we can publish papers, we can write books, we can make money off of that research. They don't own their story. No. You know, I own a tiny little bit of it. And so it compels me to give back to that community, including the women in the book, and to disseminate that information in a good way. And so it takes time. It takes the building of trust and relationship. It involves following protocol. I can't just go into some Native community uninvited and say, I'm going to do this. You know, I can reach out, but I have to follow that protocol of meeting with leadership, with elders and creator, you know, to be able to do that. And then what happens is it results in a much more creative, innovative ways to address this problem, which they decide what that is versus the researcher. And it takes time, and that's why I like it. But certainly, you know, for those of us and Dr. Walker too, you know, who have been all the way through academia, it's not something that the system is good with, is allowing time and space and relationship. And the other main thing about gentle action theory is that It's not about combining it with traditional ways of knowing and being, but rather it can walk alongside it. And I really appreciate that about it.
Well, Dr. Corcoran, I really appreciate you joining us today. I know you've got a busy schedule today there in San Francisco, and you made time for our show leading off our discussion with a lot of really good insights and an overview of the data. Thank you again, and safe travels.
Thank you so much. Take care, everyone. Walk in beauty.
Thank you so much. Let's bring our next guest in now, Dr. Lori Walker at Montana State University. And Dr. Walker, let's talk a little bit about your work. You interviewed incarcerated Native women in Montana. What were common themes you heard about? What led to them being incarcerated? Did it rhyme with some of what we heard earlier from Dr. Corcoran?
Yeah, I was going to start with another study, and then I can get to the women in prison. So I want us to start with our youth. I was involved in an ACLU of Montana report called Empty Desks that was released in 2019. And in that report, I did the data analysis with Montana as a case example, looking at school year 2015 to 2016. And we found statistics that Indigenous students faced the highest disparities in our community. They were arrested at 6 times the rate as their white peers in school. They had out-of-school suspensions that were at nearly 6 times the rate as well. And Indigenous female students had the highest school-related arrest rates for all students. They were arrested at 12 times the rate of white students. And then when we look at adults and that adult study that we did in 2017, some of what we found is that this school arrest data meets or exceeds the trends for the next generation, those adults in those same communities. Our Indigenous females make up less than 7% of the state of Montana population, but they were 36% of those incarcerated in Montana in 2016. And our Indigenous females were also 12% of the 2015-16 school student population, but 62% of the female school-related arrests. So we see trends of this, what we described earlier in the show as school to prison pipeline. And to kind of supplement some of what Dr. Corcoran was talking about, in our sample, when there were law enforcement officers in the school, there were disparities even at the placement of those officers in school. 40% of schools on reservations had a law enforcement officer present versus only 15% of schools that were not on reservations. And we also see in the state of Montana, the trends have shifted over time. We've had 7% of the population were Native American women in 1911 to 1941. And currently, or in 2016, at the time that we were doing our studies, 36% of the population, almost 6 times the rate of the Native women population in Montana, were of the women incarcerated in Montana. And the last two statistics I wanted to add to what Dr. Corcoran was talking about with Montana as a case example is Dr. Luana Ross, who wrote the book Inventing the Savage, basically did the study that I did in 2017, back in 1998 was the publication date. She found that 90% of the women in her sample in Montana's prisons had experienced violence in their lifetime. And I also wanted to mention the difference between 18% in her sample having a parole revocation versus 73% in my sample having a parole revocation in 2017 as the reason they were sitting in prison. And there are a lot of interesting stories behind that parole revocation. There's another ACLU report that's national that talks about those trends and focuses on Montana. A lot of times their parole is being revoked and they're sitting in a jail and eventually a prison cell over something minor, like not being able to get into living in a really rural area and having a jurisdiction that requires a very long drive in the winter for someone who doesn't have a driver's license to go do a spontaneous urine analysis for drug use. Little things like that causing someone to get a parole revocation and landing back in prison. It's not committing another crime. It's being caught in a system where it's nearly impossible for them to meet the conditions of probation and parole.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Walker. And what are some of the stories that you're hearing from these women? I mean, just if you're comfortable sharing, just some of the experiences that they're undergoing, just what it's like for them emotionally to have to deal with this. And again, just for example, not having access to parole or not having access to bail money and having to sit there and just await a trial, what are they telling you?
So a lot of what they're describing, and we're hearing the same thing from students in schools, some of the population have issues with mental health. If you 90% of the population experience violence, a lot of them in our sample, when we ask them about their lives growing up, when we ask them about their life circumstances, when they picked up their criminal charges, there's almost always some sort of grief and loss happening. Their sister died, their parents died, a close friend, and that may lead to engaging with their friends and family in a way that might lead to temporarily drinking more at that time. So there's almost always this unresolved grief, as in psychology we describe complicated grief, something that is unresolved. It's layer upon layer upon layer of experiences with grief that are tied to communities that have experienced intergenerational trauma. And often they have good professional careers and they're raising their kids and things are going well, but there's a series of experiences with grief that might lead to a difference in some of their actions and behaviors that then lead to law enforcement involvement at that moment in time. And then that intergenerational trauma and mental health, sometimes when they're out in a halfway house or something in the community, there may be something that happens when they're out in the community at their job or something that's going on with their family, like wanting to go see someone who's sick, but not getting permission to go, wanting to attend a funeral to move through the grief process. Something might, maybe there's drugs in the place where they're supposed to stay and they're struggling with their recovery. And so there's maybe a little anxiety about going back to the place where they're supposed to sleep for the night. And sometimes just showing up late, returning back as they're dealing with their anxiety and trying to make themselves go back to the place they're assigned to be, that in and of itself can turn into an incident where there's a revocation of parole and reincarceration. So they tried to just describe what their lives were like, that it was really kind of an ordinary thing that someone else might experience, but because they're late and because they're in the system, it can lead to being reincarcerated.
Mm-hmm. I've learned from knowing people that have been incarcerated, that, and especially like with the system that you're describing, it kind of has a cascading effect. And what can start out as a very small issue can just cascade and get bigger and bigger when somebody doesn't have the resources, perhaps, or the finances to mount a legal challenge to whatever it is they're facing. Dr. Walker, you also did this report on the school to prison pipeline in Montana. What were the main takeaways there?
So a lot of what we're finding, because the schools where the rates are so disproportionately high for our Native students have those law enforcement officers in schools, we're seeing in those same schools that they don't have the support staff they need. Our schools are significantly underfunded. They're regularly trying to pick between different interventions that they think are best for their community. But what we found was that the schools with the law enforcement officers had double the out-of-school suspensions, 9 times more arrests, 4 times more referrals, and 86% more arrests than the other schools. And so you look at patterns and trends, there's a lack of social workers, a lack of nurses, other people offering support staff services that come from those same pots of funding. And so some of what we've been hearing from our communities as we run the numbers by them and ask them, like Dr. Corcoran was talking about, what are the solutions? They're saying we need social workers. So we ran those numbers as well. And we found that when schools have the one social worker per 250 students that is recommended by national accreditation standards, there are 7 times less the number of suspensions. There's half as many arrests. And so we are recommending that schools build those supportive interventions in place so that when a student has a need that is understandably there due to intergenerational trauma and the things that they're experiencing in the present, that they have people there to help them navigate those challenges.
Well, what do you think's driving that in these schools? They're doubling down on the law enforcement personnel, but not on the support staff, not the nurses, not the social workers, like you mentioned. Why is that? Do they understand the data like you do?
I think they do understand the data, but we also hear stories about how challenging it is. I have a colleague that works on a reservation as a principal and formerly as a superintendent. There are real challenges. There are, you know, meth and other drug use that causes disturbances in the school, and they're having to pick between figuring out how to keep the students and the staff safe in the school, given the larger climate around the school and the community, and staffing another program that might be more proactive.
Gotcha. Well, we've got a couple minutes before our next break here, Dr. Walker. Let's talk more about possible solutions here, justice reform, prison reform. What have you seen working with regard to Native people?
So in the schools, I'll start there, we believe that students in sixth grade and below should not receive exclusionary discipline, so that could be banned in our schools. We could also end the permanent and routine policing of our schools and limit law enforcement presence in our schools to things that do involve serious criminal law matters that have an imminent threat to students and teachers. We also, there are a lot of great interventions that are happening on the Flathead Reservation in Montana, focused around holistic defense, making sure that people have supportive housing, and a lot of collaborations that are happening to try to make the court systems more efficient. So people who are sitting in a jail cell might get a mental health evaluation by an expert, so that by the time it goes to the judge in that jurisdiction, they already have a sense of what's going on in that person's life and whether treatment or incarceration is a better fit.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Walker. We're going to take another short break, and we come back, we're going to talk more about this issue here, Native American women and the challenges they face in the nation's prison. And you can join our conversation. Give us a call. We've got the phone lines open right now, 1-800-99-NATIVE. Once again, that number, 1-800-99-NATIVE. Give us a call. We'll get your comments on the air. What do you know about this issue? Are you familiar with some of the challenges facing Native women in prison? Let us know. 1-800-99-NATIVE.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
This is Native America Calling. I'm your host, Sean Spruce. We're focusing on justice and prison reform, and this program is part of our Native Americans in the Justice System series, supported in part by the Public Welfare Foundation. Still plenty of time to join this discussion. If you've been to prison or through juvenile corrections, what kind of support and resources helped you? Let us know. We're at 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-996-2848. Our third guest joins us now from Anchorage, Alaska. Dean Williams is an independent consultant. And Dean, welcome again to the show. And let's talk more about Alaska. Studies and reports point to that state as having one of the highest incarceration rates for Native Americans and Alaska Natives. Does that surprise you?
Well, Sean, thanks again for having me on the show. No, it doesn't surprise me. And let me say, Dr. Walker and Dr. Corcoran's comments, even though this is the first time I've heard them talk, are spot on. You know, I led the Alaska Department of Corrections for 3 years, went on to lead the Colorado Department of Corrections as the executive director for 4 years. Before that, I was also led the state's largest juvenile facility here in Alaska, McLaughlin Youth Center. So I have seen this issue, I guess, from the inside and in a leadership position. And it's a issue that when I was in all of those positions, I tried to raise with mild success in some areas, but it's a pernicious issue, and it was when I was in leadership. And so it's not only doesn't surprise me, it underscores what some of us in leadership positions have tried to address with, albeit very minimal or no success in some cases.
And what is driving that trend, Dean, these high rates of incarceration for Native Americans and Alaska Natives in the state of Alaska?
Well, this is true not only, I think, for Alaska, but I think elsewhere. Alaska also has the unique distinction, and not a good one, in terms of having some of the highest recidivism rates across the board. So we already know, like as Dr. Walker and Dr. Corcoran have sort of alluded to, is that while we, as a country, we incarcerate more than anywhere else in the world, right? Scooped up into that is a completely disproportionate incarceration of Alaska Native populations and American Indian populations when I led Colorado. And so we know that just the higher rate of incarceration is going to unfortunately scoop up the Alaska Native populations in the regions wherever they're at. There's two things that I think continue to drive this problem from where I have sat. One is that the punitive nature of prisons in the country has been a long battle that I'm not the only one who's led led state systems who believe this. There, I have other colleagues, fortunately, who feel the same way, but we've had a very punitive view of how we should incarcerate people, right? We've doubled down on what we think punishment is. And so we've made prisons a place of punishment instead of the punishment being the sentence, right? And so that's the first thing I think we've gotten wrong. The second thing we've gotten wrong that has continued to compound why Native populations around the country get scooped up into the system more is that our reentry strategies have really fallen down. And I think Dr. Walker alluded to some of the parallels of when you get certain systemic issues wrong, like reentry. And there's examples of how those things have gone wrong around the country, and especially how they impact people of color and indigenous populations. But this problem is exacerbated across the board, not just with indigenous populations, but overall. So there's some things we've gotten wrong and that we've had a hard time sort of admitting that we have.
Well, Dean, let's talk about number one. You say the punitive nature of prison. So what is an alternative that takes less emphasis on the punishment portion and perhaps creates a system that is not only better for some of these inmates, but also better for society? Because there's a lot of people that are going to be listening to this show and they're going to be thinking, well, geez, you know, some of these people in prison, they need to be there. They're dangerous. They've committed horrible crimes, and there needs to be some accountability there. What's your thought?
Well, on the latter part first, I would agree. Having run two state correctional systems and even running a juvenile facility, there are some people who need to get taken out of a circumstance because things have gone so horribly wrong. So, yes, there are dangerous people in prison. I've met them. I see them. I'm glad. I'm not a prison abolitionist. I'm very much saying, hey, there's a place and a time. Here's the problem is that we scoop up a whole bunch of people into this. I think Brian Stevenson sometimes refers to it as we want to punish the crime, right? And so we've enhanced sentences across the country, made incarceration longer. So one of the remedies or one of the solutions is really, and it's found footholds in different parts of the country, is really alternatives to incarceration for those crimes, for those incidents where people clearly have drug addiction issues. Dr. Walker mentioned, I think, the issue of women in general in terms of gender issues being subject to domestic violence, sexual abuse, drug addiction. And many of those people can be pulled out, both Alaska, you know, Native populations and women specifically because of gender-specific issues for them, but in the population as a whole. And places across the country have done that. Unfortunately, this becomes very political, right? And you scoop this up, and people who are in political leadership positions, because I've talked about this at length, they're worried about some being viewed again as being soft on crime. I try to push back and say, look, no, this isn't about being soft on crime. This is about being smart on crime. And we don't need to have people sitting in prison who, with a little bit of intervention, a little bit of treatment. And by the way, there's pockets of hope. I mean, drug courts are one of them. I think drug courts are great. The problem is the remedy for the problem is very small in terms of drug courts. So there are ways to peel people out, right, who are not the most dangerous, who have not committed very serious violent crimes. Because a lot of people are sitting in prison right now, this is not newsflash, but
because of drug issues, right? And there are ways that you can peel those people out, and as there's pockets of hope around the country, it's just that whether or not you have the political will to do it or not.
Thank you, Dean. Let's take a caller now. We have Chanupa, who is in Pine Ridge, South Dakota. He's listening on Keeley Radio. Hello, Chanupa. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Sean, for having another extraordinary show. And this goes to all of the people that are talking about the incarceration of our people. Many are women. Many times over, like we say in Lakota, it's no good to really incarcerate anybody, okay? So one thing that a lot of these brothers and sisters that are talking about this subject, okay, may a state court enforce the judgment against Indian people? That's one of the number one things. Well, in the fact of reality, no, they cannot do that. Because laws are set for Caucasian people, but they don't apply to Native people. We as Native people have our own laws through the treaties of 1861. But let's go back to what he just talked about and all the rest of them. Do you believe people should be incarcerated because of the crime? We never had crime in our country until the Caucasians got here back in 1492. Everything has a way of finding a solution to help our people that are incarcerated. And here's what needs to be done. If you have a majority of people that are sentenced, no matter what that crime is, it's crimes against humanity because they're not looking what authorizations that certain states and the federal government have and apply with jurisdiction. Now, if you incarcerate somebody like a full-blooded Indian girl, I represented four of them here in Pine Ridge and then in the states, and I defeated them. Why? Because our laws are different from state laws. We have our own way. It's called a Katela society, a grandmother society, okay? So if the courts would acknowledge Indian procedures, then you won't have the large incarceration rate of men and women, especially the young kids in the schools. See, over a contrary of history, the Supreme Court held that in 1992, that you have to allow the tribal governments to intervene right away. That's no different than the Indian Child Welfare Act that was created in 1978. So that's my question I give to women. Thank you for another extraordinary show, John. Wopila from Pine Ridge. Aho!
All right, Chanupa, I appreciate that. And what you say, Chanupa, really echoes with what we heard earlier from Dr. Corcoran with regard to her comment that, you know, the first incarceration really happened when Europeans arrived and was manifested through reservations and boarding schools and such. So, Dean, I'd like to have you respond. And also, I also would like to have Dr. Walker respond as well. But Dean, you first, because you've worked in prisons. And I would imagine that a lot of folks managing prisons, a lot of these people are probably pretty conservative. And what are their thoughts? What is their reaction when somebody suggests what our caller Chanupa says? Hey, you know, these prisons, this is not the way Native people, it's not in line with our culture. It's not the way we traditionally dealt with crimes or issues like this. I mean, are they receptive to these types of ideas, or do they just shut them down and say, no, you know, those aren't going to work, and we're just going to double down on what we've been doing all along? What's your thought, Dean?
Well, I love Chanupa's question and, I guess, comments about this. And I think the answer to that is that you get both, right? I've always been a big fan of tribal courts and tribal interventions in cases. Again, there's some success in some areas, but across the board, these systems are very hard to change. So the reality of it is that for many leaders in these systems, including myself, who is a Caucasian person who doesn't have the lived experience, but understands the historical context of what's happened in our country, and especially here in Alaska as well, it's not hard for me to admit, after being in these positions, that something's not working, right? That something's broken. And alternatives like tribal courts and allowing, you know, processes, it doesn't fix the entire problem, but it's a move in the right direction in terms of allowing tribal entities to have say over particular levels of crime. This makes a whole bunch of other people very nervous, by the way, and I get that. and there's examples they'll bring up to say, see, it didn't work there, or there was a really bad outcome on a particular case there. But the problem is that our own justice system has some pretty profound outcomes at times, and especially when you look at recidivism rates between both states I led. Like, just use that data point alone to say something's not right. You can't have 65% of the people in Alaska getting out of prison, coming back to prison again. And it's been that way for decades. In my home state that I love dearly, there's a problem when 65% of the people get out of prison and return to prison. And by the way, a big proportion of the Alaska Native population is overrepresented, and the Native women are overrepresented as well. That's a problem. So it should force us to find other alternatives, if you will. So Chinupa's right that if there was more opportunities on tribal governments and tribal courts, again, this causes a great debate among Department of Laws and Attorney General's offices around the country, and I get that. But just look at the results we're getting, and that should at least crack open the door for other alternatives.
All right. Dr. Walker, I'd like you to respond as well. Through your research, what have you learned with regard to tribal or traditional solutions with regard to criminal justice?
So a few thoughts. Luana Ross has a quote where she talks about a Nez Perce woman saying that the word for imprisonment in her language literally means darkness. It is not a place or a location, but a condition. And when we're out in places like the Flathead Reservation in Montana and doing practices like holistic defense that center what that individual coming through the criminal justice system says are their priorities and their needs, if their most important thing to them is to maintain a connection to their children, then they rep the lawyers in the public defender's office at the tribal level center that and focus on trying to do whatever they need to in that criminal justice system that they're within to offer services first, invest in culturally relevant research and services to those clients of theirs. They listen to the clients and the community. They adhere to cultural safety. And I think about things like the wiping of the tears ceremony in the Lakota community that can help manage grief that were outlawed. Ceremonial and cultural practices were outlawed by the U.S. government. Bringing back practices like those that are also rooted in those original indigenous practices. Sarah Deer and other advocates across the nation talk about what she say it be law is this concept that was in the Muscogee Creek community, that if a woman experiences violence and she says that this is the way she wants that managed in her community, the community believed her, got behind her. And then Dr. Corcoran's interventions also have phenomenal outcomes. She's worked with women in prison who are Native for 2+ years and built a sense of community with them where that those recidivism rates, I believe in the 12 or so people that she's worked with, only two have not had success. I think one died and one went back to prison. The other 10 have built a sense of community and support for each other. But our criminal justice systems presume that that relationship that they have with each other should be cut off the second they step out of the prison and reenter, because we assume that they're not good for each other out in the community. And so there are small things like that that we can change in the reentry process that value the good, pro-social, supportive cultural supports that can be built while they're in prison.
Well, I really appreciate Dr. Lori Walker, Dr. Karma Corcoran, and also Dean Williams for joining our show today and sharing their knowledge, their expertise. Unfortunately, we are now out of time, so I'm going to go ahead and wrap up this discussion. But for those of you listening to the show, please connect with us on social media. Tell us what you thought of this show. If you've got any comments to share, any insights, you can check us out on Facebook. You can check us out on Instagram. You can also post on our website at NativeAmericaCalling.com. Tune in to NAC again tomorrow for a discussion about unsubstantiated and divisive rhetoric by public officials targeting tribes. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day. I'm Sean Spruce.
Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com. Skuktash.
For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods, tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Omnye.
April, National Alcohol Awareness. Ikayo Louis to help yourself. Elisimo Fium Insure Louis to Marketplace. You make Lifsinium qualify on Yachtusi for treatment option. For more information, contact your local health care provider. Naka Visitor Louis Healthcare.gov. Naka Kaler Louis 1-800-318-2596. Message Hydro Center for Medicare Medicaid Service.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.